May it please the court, my name is Michael Steinle. I represent Rahed Zahir in this matter. I'm not going to go through all the facts, but by way of immigration, Rahed Zahir was an immigrant in this country. He'd only been in this country from Jerusalem and grew up in the West Bank. Came over to this country 19 years ago, and at that time his father was running some stores in the Kenosha, Wisconsin area. And the defendant eventually takes over the stores. His two brothers are also part of the stores. There's two stores in concern here. One of the younger brothers runs one of the stores. The other younger brother runs the other store. And the defendant, if you will, because he's the eldest of the family, and by culture and in his culture, he is, if you will, the head of the family, he who will inherit, if you will. He gets involved in this conspiracy.
All these things, even if we won't.
Excuse me?
Go ahead, but you use the phrase, if you will, about five times in quick succession, and all of these things are true or not, whether or not we will.
Okay. Defendant gets involved in this conspiracy because his lifelong friend from the West Bank is buying stolen formula, and gets the defendant to become an outlet for him, and the defendant joins the conspiracy by buying the formula from this lifelong friend from Ohio. The Department of Regulation in Wisconsin, who is actually governing this, gets wind of the fact that the defendant is doing this. They audit him and they ask him for receipts. And then he goes to this lifelong friend and says, I'm getting audited, I need receipts. And he proceeds to falsify the receipts to show that, in fact, or attempt to show that, in fact, the formula is legitimate formula from a legitimate source, because Wisconsin at that time says you have to buy from legitimate sources to stop this fraud. Regardless of that, is what I'm here to argue is just a sentencing, the role in the offense is it was my position in front of Judge Clavert that Judge Clavert should not have given him 4 points for the role in the offense. He should have merely done 2 points for the following reasons. I don't believe that this was a conspiracy with five or more participants or was otherwise extensive pursuant to the law in that area. When I say that is Ralph Barton was merely an employee. And I argue that Ralph Barton was not part of any of the illegal conduct that involved the conspiracy itself. He was involved in some relevant conduct, but he was not involved in the conspiracy himself. That is Ralph Barton, by actually a police report that is introduced, said that he bought some store, or the defendant bought some stolen milk from some thieves that would come into the store and sell a can here and there. The conspiracy had to do with buying from Amjad Salim. It had nothing to do really with buying from the streets itself. But that was relevant conduct, and I concede it was relevant conduct. But in addition to that is that Amjad Salim was the, if you will, the person who was selling the formula to the defendant. I don't believe that the defendant exercised any supervisory control, but the government said because the defendant supervised, if you will, the receipts that were being used to justify this formula somehow or another, Amjad Salim, who is technically the head of the conspiracy from Ohio, was being supervised by the defendant, so therefore he was. Same thing with a man by the name of Nasser Afawi, who actually worked for Amjad Salim. Likewise, as he was actually the government informant, the government seems to take the position that because Rayad Thayer somehow supervised these receipts, he didn't. He just went and got receipts and made them up. There was no supervision with regard to it. As to the amount of loss, I'll be brief on that issue, is the amount of loss we're talking about, some receipts. It's $103,000 of receipts. The government took the position that these Sala receipts, again, just introduced them into evidence because they're found in the search warrant, because Sala had an address that was a door down from Hala, that therefore they were illegitimate. And I submit that they actually very keenly shifted the burden of proof to me to say, well, they must be illegitimate, so therefore, by a preponderance of the evidence, we're saying that they are legitimate, and Steinle can't refute that, so therefore they're illegitimate receipts. And it is $103,000, which would take me under the $400 loss. Again, there was no proof other than the introduction of the evidence and to say that they were illegitimate, and it shifted the burden to Steinle to say they are legitimate, which was obviously hard. The last issue with regard to this is it has to do with the Rule 35C motion that I had brought. So the court knows, or this court knows, what happened was as I was walking out of court, I had asked for the drug treatment program for my client because cocaine was found in his home as well as some marijuana, and I asked the court to consider the 500-hour drug treatment program. Judge Clavert, as he was leaving, said that he had overlooked that issue and that, in fact, I should bring the police reports or file the police reports with the court to show that, in fact, there was a Kenosha County case, State of Wisconsin versus Riot Tahir, which he was charged with, actually, the cocaine and the marijuana in the house. He did not know that. He indicated to me that it should be brought pursuant to a Rule 35C motion. I brought the motion with regard to it, and then sua sponte, when we had the hearing with regard to that, Judge Clavert said, in retrospect, he thought that he was a little harsh on the defendant, as I had honestly not won one of my objections to the pre-sentence report. He said he thought and believed that, in fact, he was harsh on the defendant and resentenced him from 60 months down to 48 months in the government appealed. And I think rightfully so. When I say that is that there was not a vehicle, and to this day I did not know that until this case and did the research, is there is no vehicle for a judge to correct himself. When he, in retrospect, after he leaves the bench, said, you know, I guess I should have, if you will, conceded one of these issues or two of these issues. So then what he does is under a Rule 35C motion, he tries to do that under what I argued from, I argued 2 points for a departure motion, that is a departure from the guidelines, but because they were they're not mandatory anymore, I did it under 18 United States Code 3553 motion and argued that the deportation would have just a substantial effect on, unlike anything else that I've ever argued before a court in this case, and that is the defendant, after he is imprisoned, is going to be deported. Unfortunately, he brought 3 children into this world that are now United States citizens. When this case got investigated, his wife was here, and she had overstayed her visa, so she got deported. And now the defendant is deported, and now the children are left here without mom and dad with regard to it. And they're United States citizens, and to go back to their country would be violent, and it's a very chaotic world. It's a very unrestful world for 3 American citizens to grow up in. And Judge Clavert found it, I believe, in his heart, saying, maybe I was too harsh on this. Maybe I should give the defendant less time, and he did. Unfortunately, there's not a vehicle, but at least it does shed some light on my appeal in this case, is that I think Judge Clavert, in retrospect, would have looked at the acceptance of responsibility or the amount of loss in this case or the supervisory role, and under, if you will, the cloak of deportation that, in fact, he was too harsh.
The deportation issue has nothing to do with the length of the sentence, though. He's going to be deported one way or another.
That's correct. But I think there is some case law with regard to that a court can take into consideration the fact that he does voluntarily deport to lessen the time, if you will, for him if he does voluntarily deport. There is some authority for
that.
But
the point is the impact on the kids is the same, whether he does a 48-month sentence or a 60-month sentence.
Well, yes and no. When I say that is that in this culture, unfortunately, that his mother is back at home and she's a second-class citizen. She can't work. The defendant at least can be out of prison, if you will, and back in his country and work and be sending money back to his children. In fact, to get an education, to further their education, and to support his children. So the sooner he would get back, whether it be in this community or whether it's his community from his childhood, he can at least work and support his children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Campbell.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Scott Campbell. I'm an assistant United States attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. Your Honors, I'd like to address three of the points raised in our brief. First, that the district court did not clearly err by assessing a 4-level increase for an aggravating role in the offense. Mr. Tahir suggests first that he should not have received a 4-level increase as an organizer because his criminal activity did not involve 5 or more participants. And the focus, at least of his initial argument, is that store employee Ralph Barton was not involved in the criminal activity. I submit that the district court had an ample record for finding that Mr. Barton was, in fact, intimately involved in the criminal activity. As Mr. Barton himself stated, and this, his statements are reflected in the PSR, and these statements were not objected to by Mr. Thahir, Mr. Barton advised that he personally obtained stolen infant formula at Mike's Foods on behalf of Mr. Thahir, who oversaw both operations, both stores that the family ran in Kenosha, Wisconsin. One, of course, was Mike's Foods, where Mr. Barton worked. The other one was located about two blocks away, Fast and Friendly Market. But Mr. Barton stated that he received stolen products, including infant formula, from people who come in off the street. Mr. Thahir directed Mr. Barton to receive that product. Mr. Thahir also directed Mr. Barton to inventory the product so that Mr. Thahir would know how much to pay the thief. And Mr. Thahir further instructed Mr. Barton to clean the product and to prepare it for resale, which Mr. Thahir then engaged in. So in short, Mr. Thahir oversaw three really important aspects of Mr. Barton's job that involved the receipt and resale of stolen property. Mr. Thahir caused Mr. Barton to receive the property, to inventory it, and to clean it and prepare it for resale. So for all those reasons, it's plain that Mr. Barton was involved in this criminal activity. Additionally, as the court well knows, a four-level enhancement is appropriate under Sentencing Guideline 3B1.1 if the criminal activity in which the defendant was involved was otherwise extensive. And I submit that even on this alternative ground, a four-level enhancement would be appropriate as well because, of course, we know that from the record, from the findings of fact that the district court made and the findings suggested by the PSR to which Mr. Thahir did not object, that Mr. Thahir was engaged in buying stolen infant formula in all the ways I suggested before. Additionally, he was involved in WIC and food stamp fraud in the sense that women and infant children recipients and recipients of food stamps would come in and he would sell them unapproved food items. He would also cash out WIC vouchers as opposed to redeeming them for infant formula, which of course would throw off his inventory numbers. And additionally, on some occasions, Mr. Thahir would accept the WIC voucher for infant formula and then indirectly traffic in WIC benefits by causing the person who brought the voucher in to go to the other family-run store and then sell that can of formula for 50 cents on the dollar. So in short, Mr. Thahir was involved not only in dealing in stolen infant formula, the stuff that he bought from drug addicts and thieves who came in off the street. He also bought it, of course, in the underlying conspiracy from Amjad Salem, his friend in Ohio. And in addition to that, he was trafficking in WIC vouchers and food stamp benefits, all of which would cause his inventory numbers to be off. And that goes to the heart of this case. As Your Honors, I'm sure, well appreciate, Mr. Thahir was then involved in sort of the core criminal conduct at issue in this case, which was the cover-up. When the WIC fraud investigator, David Beam, came to the store in the summer of 2003 and asked Mr. Thahir for inventory receipts to justify the WIC redemptions that the store had made, including for infant formula, Mr. Thahir soon thereafter contacted his friend Amjad Salem in Ohio, asked that false invoices be made. He made that phone call on July 10 of 2003, and then only 2 days later, Mr. Thahir drove to Dayton, Ohio, and personally oversaw the creation of the bogus invoices that he and his brothers submitted to the WIC program in this case to throw WIC off the scent that these men were, in fact, dealing in stolen formula and trafficking in WIC vouchers. Thus, the record amply supports the district court's conclusion that Mr. Thahir was a supervisor of criminal activity that involved five or more participants, and those, of course, included not only himself, but his two brothers, Murad Daher and Fuad Zahir, as well as Mr. Barton and Amjad Salem, not to mention the drug addicts and thieves who would bring in items to sell to the store. So in short, Your Honors, the record amply supported the district court's finding that Mr. Thahir deserved a four-level increase for his aggravating role as an organizer or leader of this criminal activity.
I'm not real clear on the theory of the amount of loss.
I'd be happy to address that, Your Honor.
Which had to do with fraudulent receipts from Hala Wholesale and Sala Wholesale, which are in Philadelphia, not Ohio or Wisconsin?
I'd be happy to address that. Fundamentally, the loss amount was calculated in this case by comparing the amount of WIC redemptions that were made over a 25-month period from the summer of 01 to the summer of 03 by Mike's Foods and Fast and Friendly. And then backing out of that, the product that they redeemed that had legitimate inventory purchase invoices. So in other words, the question that WIC was asking was, are you dealing in stolen property? And so they said, you know, give us your invoices. They submitted false invoices to cover the fact they were dealing in stolen property. So the theory of loss, Your Honor, the loss is calculated by figuring how much they redeemed through the program, and then of that amount, how much was supported by legitimate invoices. Now, the open question in this case concerns the invoices from Salah Wholesale, which amounted to just over $100,000. I believe it was about $103,000. The district court reasonably inferred that those invoices were false, and it had an ample record for doing so. Now, it's true that Mr. Tahir can offer a competing inference, but as this court knows, a district court cannot be found to have clearly erred when it's choosing between two reasonable competing inferences. I would add that in this case, Mr. Tahir did nothing but put the government to its proof. It's not as though he offered his own competing inference. So let's look at the evidence the government presented and that the district court relied upon to find that those Salah invoices were false. First, we know that the Halah invoices were bogus, and we know that because when David Beam went to the store, he's the WIC fraud investigator, went to Mr. Tahir, he said, give me your invoices. And the first thing that Mr. Tahir did was to go to store employee Ralph Barton. And this also goes to rolling the offense. He said, Mr. Barton, please create false invoices. Barton refused. Then Barton saw Tahir go to Halah Wholesale and Fresh and Pure and get blank invoices. That statement is corroborated by the fact that during the May 4, 2004 search of these stores, we found 12 blank Halah Wholesale invoices, two at Mike's Foods and two at the related market, Fast and Friendly Market. It is not normal for a supplier to give to its customer blank invoices. In addition, I would refer to the court to page 29 of the government's brief, where he pointed out that those Halah invoices are bogus because of the fact that the dates are all off and the invoice numbers are all off. You have higher numbered invoices that should come later that have earlier dates interspersed among completed and incomplete Halah Wholesale invoices. Now, that takes us to Salah Wholesale. We know that the Halah ones are bogus. What about Salah? Why did the district court reasonably infer Salah invoices were bogus just because the Halah ones were as well? Well, those two stores are intimately related. They're run by the same owner, Subi Ahmed. They're run from street addresses that are right next door to each other. 1848 and 1850, I'm drawing a blank on the street, in Philadelphia. Additionally, Subi Ahmed was known to deal in stolen products through Salah Wholesale. That is a finding that is recommended in the PSR, to which Mr. Tahir did not object. So for all those reasons, the district court reasonably inferred that given that the Halah Wholesale invoices, again, that Subi Ahmed provided to Red Tahir, many of which were blank, that given that he had provided bogus Halah Wholesale invoices, that the Salah Wholesale invoices were likewise bogus.
So those amounts were simply subtracted from the total amount of WIC redemptions for the operative time period? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, for infant formula, Your Honor, yes.
Okay.
Finally, I'd like to briefly address the Rule 35 issue, and that is kind of as to whether the sentence was reasonable, the issue before the court is whether the district court's change of heart that it ultimately did not follow up on suggests that the originally imposed sentence was unreasonable. And I submit that the answer is no. Merely because the district court had a change of heart did not mean that its original sentence was unreasonable. To the contrary, the court reached that original sentence of 60 months after carefully considering pertinent 3553A factors. Those included the need to reflect the seriousness of the offense and to deter similar conduct like this in the future. I want to point out importantly that there is an error in the government's brief. In the brief, we indicated that the properly calculated guidelines range was 78 to 97 months. That was an error. That was what was in the PSR. We objected to obstruction. The properly calculated range should have been 63 to 78 months, which was still a higher range than the court imposed. Yet another reason why the sentence imposed was reasonable. Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Penn?
Just very, very briefly. With regard to Ralph Barton, my objection to this is that Ralph Barton, the only thing the government did was just introduce a police report, and he wasn't subject to cross-examination. So many of the things that are coming in were obviously not subject to cross-examination. I take issue with that this is an otherwise extensive conspiracy. This was buying stolen milk from a childhood friend. That's all. There wasn't anything extensive about this. And to say that Raed Tahir oversaw the creation of false invoices of Amjad Salim, no, he didn't. He went to him and he got the receipts and he made up the receipts. He didn't oversee anything with regard to someone he was purchasing. And Amjad Salim had every interest, obviously, in falsifying this because the government was looking at him at the same time and ultimately did get indicted. As to the legitimate invoices with the Sala versus Hala, exactly what I said is that the government shifts the burden to the defense in this case, and all they do is introduce it and say, and he said it right here to the court. He said, well, Steinle never objected. They never came forward with it with any other evidence. And I'm not required to do that. The government is required to do
that. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.